Meeting of the Crime Victims Criminal Records Division will come to order. Oh, that's just the thing. First, we need a motion for the minutes. Representative Hillstrom. Thank you. Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes from March 13, 2003, which he has carefully reviewed. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. First order of business is Sheldon. Sheldon's here. Representative Johnson, are you prepared on House File 1043? Representative Tamar, would you move Representative Johnson's House File 1043?
So moved.
Okay, the bill has been moved. Representative Johnson, to your bill.
Thank you, Representative Bless. I also have a delete all, if you'd be so kind as to move that as well.
Representative Tamar will move the 163 amendment. Are there any questions? First of all, Representative Johnson, why don't you explain what that delete all does? Actually, Representative Paymar does move it.
I need to get it through the deal.
Okay. Then that's the motion also from Representative Paymar to put the bill in the shape that the author desires under the amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes to your bill as amended then, Representative Johnson. And why don't you explain what that did?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Basically, the delete all made some changes in the way the issue of public employment is considered with respect to folks with criminal records. And what this bill is, members, is a bill to give a little help to those individuals who have had some problems with the law. And the bill is directed at public employment. Not at private employees, although it could serve as a best practice model for private employees. And if you look at the delete all, section 1 and paragraph A, it says a public employer may not inquire into or consider the criminal record or criminal history of an applicant for public employment until the applicant has been selected for an interview by the employer. So essentially what it does is, it doesn't eliminate criminal record inquiries or background checks. You wait until the applicant has been selected for an interview. So it lets the person get his foot in the door, put a human face on the applicant, give them a chance to present themselves. And I'd like to just, as someone who works in corrections, I've been in the field for 30 plus years, I can tell you from my own experience that the best form of rehabilitation is for someone to have a job and to get employment. And the best predictor that I've seen in working with guys and not coming back is whether they're gainfully employed. So if we can get folks who've had some problems working and help them along that path, we have a much greater likelihood of them being successfully integrated into community. I also do, in my current job, I'm the hearing officer at the Ramsey County Workhouse. So that's our local county jail in St. Paul, and I do the discipline hearing for guys that get in trouble, five, 10 cases a day. I can tell you that of the 500-plus folks at the workhouse, there's probably 100 that are either on work release or home confinement that have a job situation. These guys aren't the ones getting in trouble. These aren't the folks I see for disciplinary procedures because they have something to gain because they're employed, they have something to work for, they're doing something productive. So you see from a practical level, you see from a safety level as far as getting people involved in their own community, and you see it in terms of their own rehabilitation, that helping folks, particularly those who have some problems with the law or with criminal behavior, to get them to have some kind of stake and some involvement again in their community, particularly through employment, is an excellent way to go. And this bill helps us move in that direction.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. You have a testifier?
Yeah, we have with us Elizabeth Glidden, from councilmember from the city of Minneapolis, and she's going to say a few words about this particular bill.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Councilmember Glidden, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Elizabeth Glidden, and I'm a council member for the city of Minneapolis. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for allowing me to testify here today. I wanted to tell you just a little bit about the city of Minneapolis experience, because we are very proud of Minneapolis that the doors open just a little bit wider for individuals with a criminal record to become employed by the city. And this started in 2006 when Councilmember Don Samuels, who represents the North Side, and I worked together with the Council on Crime and Justice and our city's own Human Resources Department to discuss this change to our hiring practices that would remove from the city application the box requiring disclosure of past criminal history. And the change actually took place in December of 2006. It had unanimous approval of the council. It had the support of the mayor. And I think it's important to say that it also had the support of our Human Resources Department after they had gone through and vetted the idea. And under this fair hiring practices resolution that we passed, background checks are still performed. They're performed for about two-thirds of our city jobs within the city of Minneapolis, but only after a conditional job offer has been given. And when we adopted this policy, we believed that this was the right thing to do. We thought it was a pro-safety policy. We thought it would be something that would improve quality of life for individuals with a criminal record, and we're very well aware that in Minneapolis, we often get individuals who may have served their time elsewhere and lived elsewhere, but they moved to Minneapolis after they had served their time to try to make a life and get jobs and housing. And so we knew this was something that we thought would strengthen our communities and send a loud and clear message to those individuals that we want you to succeed, we want you to lead productive lives. And so I am really happy to report to you today that after about 2 years of implementing this new policy, we do believe this is a decision that benefited Minneapolis. And I had passed out to you a sheet that has a kind of little box like this on it. And this is prepared by our own city's Human Resources Department. And here are some of the broad-based results that we have found. We have found that fewer applicants are being rejected due to a criminal conviction. And we've done this by comparing number of background checks performed to those applicants hired and looking at those where there were concerns with the background checks. Another thing that we think is important is that at the time we instituted this policy, we were unclear whether this would add to the workload of our staff and essentially be a cost. And we found after implementing the policy that actually the opposite was true. That considering the criminal conviction information at the time of the job offer decreased transactional amount of work for our staff and thus was somewhat of a cost savings. And the third thing that I think is important for a public employer is we often are, I think, struggling with making sure the application process goes quickly and smoothly enough for our departments to hire employees. And we found that reviewing the convictions with a concern at the job offer stage did not slow down the hiring process. So we thought that these were excellent results. Some of them were surprising results, and that the initial goal, which was to have a better vetting process where we allowed individuals with a criminal conviction an opportunity to present themselves and then have to explain why they might have something on their background, this has resulted in something that our department head support and our Human Resources Department supports. So the bill you're considering, I think, will provide a positive change from the perspective of the city of Minneapolis. We have tried it. We have found that it works. And if you have any questions, I'm available.
Thank you, Councilmember Glidden. Are there questions by committee members for Representative Johnson or Councilmember Glidden? Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, for Representative Johnson, when we say public employers, are we talking all levels of government from local units of government, the Soil and Water Board, all the way up through federal agencies for public employers would be applicable under this statute?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, my understanding is we're talking all public employment, but if you look at that item B, that there is a carve-out for Department of Corrections and also for public employees who do have a statutory duty to conduct criminal history background. So there is insurance of those sorts of job situations where it makes sense to do it right from the get-go.
Chairman, I just wanted to clarify whether we were enacting a statute that would encumber federal employees. Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard to testify on this bill, House File 1043? Please step up and introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, my name is Eric Branson. I'm with Emerge Community Development.
Please proceed, Mr. Branson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As I said, my name is Eric Branson, and I am an employment facilitator at Emerge Community Development. A large part of my job involves assisting ex-felons in obtaining gainful employment. As you can imagine, this is a task that has many hurdles. One such hurdle my clients face is the question on employment applications that asks about an applicant's criminal history, and this is what I am here to speak to you about today. There are several reasons why this question on employment applications impacts the population that I work with. The first reason is the upfront discrimination that's associated with this question. The discouragement and fear of rejection are very real and oftentimes result in the feeling of hopelessness when it comes to the job search process. The second reason that this question poses a problem is that often a person's criminal background is looked at more closely than the person's actual skills and qualifications. I, too, am an ex-felon and have been denied employment as a result of having to check this box. Luckily, I've had the support from people willing to speak on my behalf on my past work experiences, as well as found an employer who values my knowledge, skills, and abilities more than what a piece of paper states that I did in the past. However, if no one would have given me a chance, I would not be where I am today. In my experience, both as an applicant and as an employment counselor, I've come across this question worded in very vague and confusing ways. For example, it may read something like, "Have you been convicted of a felony in the last 7 years?" Well, this sounds simple enough, but in fact can be interpreted very differently by different people. What I'm asking you to consider is not a ban on the discussion of an individual's criminal history, but simply to take this question off of application so that it cannot be used as a tool for discrimination and so that the applicant can be judged on their merit, qualifications, and skills. This legislation would improve the lives of my clients. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Branson. Any of the testifiers on this bill in the audience? Is there anyone here from the Department of Corrections to testify? Okay. Well, seeing none, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 1043 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Thank you. House File 1043 as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Bill passes 2-0. Okay, Representative Champion, Representative Paymar, would you move House File 891? The motion is that okay, Representative Champion, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you so much for hearing our bill this morning. This is a very important topic and issue that we believe is worth discussing and moving great public policy around. It's around juvenile expungements as well as some other information that we believe will strengthen existing laws and also provide some redemption and possibilities for people who may have made a challenging choice early on. This particular bill was brought to me by the Council on Crime and Justice, and I'm happy to have not just them here this morning, but as well as Lindsay Davis, who was very instrumental in crafting this bill along with many others. And I would like for her to provide some a backdrop as to why this particular legislation is so important. And then we'll also hear from Mark House, who's the Council on Crime and Justice. And then Nancy House will also speak to this from the perspective of, I would say, the County Attorney Association. So with that, I would like to introduce my first testifier, Lindsay Davis.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Davis, and I'm a staff attorney at Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, better known as Legal Aid. We represent low-income clients in civil matters for the entire southern half of Minnesota. Every year, we have hundreds of individuals call us asking for help stemming from a criminal record, not just criminal convictions, but also juvenile records and arrests that were never actually prosecuted or did not result in a conviction. And we found there were two groups of individuals who were particularly in need of help, that there wasn't an adequate remedy in our law to help. Number one, juvenile offenders, and number two, individuals who were somehow entered into the criminal justice system, but their case did not result in a conviction. Just focusing on the juvenile offenders, I've had the opportunity to work at the Juvenile Detention Center for many years, volunteering with the youth who are incarcerated there. I ask almost everyone I meet, what type of record do you think will result from being here? Who can find out about your juvenile record? And they all tell me, well, no one, it's private. My juvenile record's going to go away when I turn 18. And we know that's not the case in Minnesota. Any juvenile who's charged with a felony at the age of 16 or older can have a public record, and even individuals who are younger than that can have a criminal record that's public in many situations. As a legal aid attorney, I have many clients come to my office who have made mistakes as a teenager, even sometimes as young as 13 years old, coming in now after turning 18, asking for help, asking if I could clear their record or help them move on after they've become adults. And to be quite honest, there is no adequate remedy in our laws in Minnesota to help those individuals who made a mistake in the past but have grown up and moved on and find that their juvenile record prevents them from meeting their basic needs, quite frankly. We had one client in particular who had a theft charge that was never actually adjudicated delinquent on, and she found that after turning 18 and going to college, she was not able to pursue her path of employment. So we feel that we need to have an adequate remedy for juvenile records in this state of Minnesota. The second group of individuals are adults who were somehow entered into the criminal system through an arrest, but never actually ended up being convicted of a crime. One type of this individuals that needs help are people who, and I should say all adults who that I've met who have an arrest that was never actually resulted in a conviction believe they don't have a criminal record. And so they'll check on employment applications, they don't have a record, the public defender, the judge, no one tells them that they have a record. And they find out they have a record when it's too late, after they've been denied the job and the housing opportunity. And those individuals want us to help them with an expungement, and we have to tell them if they're eligible, it takes the better part of a year for that process to be complete. There's another set of adults who were never actually convicted of a crime, but the expungement statute as it reads right now doesn't cover their cases. Those are individuals who, for example, were in the county diversion program to divert them out of the criminal justice system, and at some point they had to admit that they did something wrong. They're not eligible for an expungement under our statute. We have other individuals who were, their case was a vacate and dismiss disposition that was not supposed to result in a conviction. Those individuals are not eligible for expungements under our laws. And finally, individuals who receive a stay of adjudication that's not a drug-related crime, also not intended to have a conviction, have a criminal record, not eligible for expungement under our laws. So we find that juveniles and adults who have cases not resulting in a conviction come to us seeking a legal remedy, and in many cases we can't find one for them in our law. So we hope that this bill will help help us help those individuals move on and provide for their families.
Questions from committee members for Representative Champion or Ms. Davis? Representative Schimansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Champion, will it cost our agencies or jurisdictions to go to court if they choose to have a record kept public?
Representative Champion.
Well, it is my understanding that there is a, well, I know that there's a provision in this legislation that will allow, let's say, for an example, if there is a person who's been charged, and let's say the county attorney's office is going to dismiss the case, that we are providing an opportunity for the court to expunge the record at that particular point. Therefore, there would be no additional cost, and the whole reason for doing this sort of legislation is so we can streamline costs. So from our vantage point, there would be a cost savings because we would have the ability to streamline it. Now, there is the possibility of a person petitioning the court sometime later for a remedy that would that could potentially result in a cost, but that's consistent with the way the system is currently. And so we believe that this is this goes in the right direction from a public policy perspective as well as a streamlining of costs. And we will definitely get a little more into the bill itself if the chair will allow us to go forward with this.
Representative Schmansky? Okay. I have a question. Ms. Davis, if I'm a 17-year-old, a 16-year-old juvenile, but I'm tried as an adult for murder, and that's a conviction. Is it your intent under this that would also be masked as a juvenile record, or is it because I'm tried as an adult, it's not? How does that work?
Unless, under our current expungement statute, 609A, juveniles who are certified adults are eligible to petition for an expungement currently. However, a murder conviction is prohibited by law from being expunged.
Okay, what are there any other crimes specifically that are prohibited?
Yes, Chairman Lesh. Any crime that requires registration, murder, sex crimes, predatory offenders, those crimes cannot be expunged unless conviction has resulted.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members on House File 891? I don't see any. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 891?
Chair Lesh, we still have we would like to go through the bill itself if we might.
I'm sorry, yes. Receiver.
Chair Lesh, in order for us to get House File number 891 in the shape that we would like for it to be in, you have two amendments that are before you.
Okay. Would you note the amendments, Representative Chair?
There's an amendment that is ends in A1.
Okay.
And then there's also a second amendment that ends in 8-5. So I'm not sure if the chair would like for me to read the entire numbers.
Why don't we get it in the shape you'd like first? To Representative Paymire, would you be so kind as to move the two amendments as stated by? Okay. Would you move A1, Representative Paymire? Okay. Representative Paymire has moved to A1 in order to get the bill in the shape that the author desires. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. And then, Representative Paymire, would you move the 185 amendment as well? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Both those amendments are now a part of the bill. So to your bill as amended, Representative Champion.
Thank you. So I will have my next testifier, who is Mark House from the Council on Crime and Justice, that will take the committee and the rest of us through the substance of the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Mark Hosey with the Council on Crime and Justice. There's quite a bit in this bill. I'll try to move really quickly, but I want to make sure everyone understands what each section does. Sections 1 and 2 change under current law. If a 16 or 17-year-old is charged with a felony-level offense, that's a public record. Section 1 and 2 would just make it so that only felony-level actual adjudications are public. Not all charges, but just the final adjudication would be public. Section 3 is actually being removed in the 185 amendment. So you can delete Section 3 if the 185 amendment goes forward. Section 4 adds juvenile records to the expungement statute, as Ms. Davis discussed. And if you look at the last part of the 185 amendment, There was a technical problem with this section, and what the 185 amendment does is makes it so that in cases where there's an adult certification or what's called an extended jurisdiction juvenile, when the person fails that and doesn't complete their probation, it treats those records the same as adult records under expungement. If it's just a juvenile adjudication, it treats those like dismissed records for expungement, which means that it's the burden is placed on the state to show that the record shouldn't be expunged. If there's questions about that, we can come back to it. Section 5, basically under current law, the way that appellate court cases have come out, they define what the statute says about cases being resolved in the person's favor as only those cases where the person hasn't pled to the facts. And so what happens is people who go through diversion programs, who have stays of adjudication under the statute, currently aren't eligible for statutory expungement. So under other case law, their records can still be found often at the BCA. This section makes it so that whenever somebody has a final dismissal, regardless of whether they pled to the facts, so for stays of adjudication, diversion programs, they can ultimately have that record expunged through the expungement process. Section 6 allows somebody who's had a record or a case dismissed to, by motion to the court, get the record sealed at the time of dismissal. And what this does is for people who basically end up in court, and this does happen sometimes, who shouldn't be there, they've been misidentified, there's been some kind of mistake, we've had individuals like this come through our seminars and clinics, this allows them to get that record sealed right at the time of dismissal, instead of having to file a petition, go to court, do all the complicated paperwork, possibly hire an attorney. And there's some changes we're working on that section with the County Attorneys Association, and I think Representative Champion is committed to working with them to make that something that the county attorneys would be able to agree to. Section 7 and 11 are just conforming. Section 8 adds a notification to victims. It's sort of a conforming section also. Section 9 changes procedure a bit. We're trying to help the courts and maybe prosecutors a bit with this. Well, currently, somebody who's filing for expungement has to serve all the parties who hold records 60 days before the hearing. What this does is for dismissed cases and low-level drug offenses that are already in the statute, if the prosecutor does not ask for a hearing, within 30 days there would be no hearing. So in a lot of cases, that would avoid the hearing process. That's another one that we're working on, some of the finer points with the County Attorneys Association to make sure that will work well. And then Section 10 is related to Section 9, and it establishes that burden of proof that I talked about earlier. And Section 12 just makes it possible so that somebody who has a expungement can come back to the court later and with proper identification get a copy of that record without having to get an order from the judge. What happens sometimes is people will get a dismissed record expunged and they'll go on to apply for a professional license, and the licensing board wants a copy of what happened with that record. And in their current law, they have to actually go to the court, get it, you know, and that costs the court more time. So this way they can just get a copy with identification. Those are all the, and actually, do you want me to talk about the A9 amendment? The A1 amendment basically takes expungement law back to its pre-2005 status. Under current case law before the Minnesota Supreme Court, it's not clear whether judges can seal executive branch records under the inherent authority of the court. And this amendment would make it so that judges would be able to seal records wherever kept or maintained. Under current law, you know, if somebody's convicted of even a misdemeanor level offense, there's no way for them to get that. There's no clear way under current case law for them to get that sealed for the rest of their life. And basically, this amendment would restore the court's ability to seal all records when they're following the burdens and the procedures created by the statute.
One question for Mr. Hasse. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Champion?
I would like Nancy Haas from the County Attorney's Office to come and just on the record allow the committee to know that we are working and we are committed to working with the County Attorney's Office.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Haas.
Association, I should say.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Nancy Haas with Methuen and Kramer here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I do want to thank Representative Champion. Our association has not taken an official position on this bill, but we have had a chance to review it briefly and have shared with him and Mark Hasse a couple of our concerns related to the bill, and he has indicated an interest in working with us. I just want to point out a couple of those really quickly. In Section 4 of the bill, one of the things we're concerned about right now is that the way that this is drafted is it allows for expungements of all crimes and offenses, and we're a little bit concerned about this under this language currently that some violent crimes could be expunged, and so we would like to rectify that, as well as on line 5.25 and 5.27, both EJJs and certified adults, we do think that those individuals should be treated under the expungement law like adults and not like juveniles. And then in section 9 on page 8, as Representative Campion mentioned and Mark Hockey mentioned, we appreciate that they're trying to, when there isn't a contested expungement, try and make quick use of this. We do have some concerns with the timing that needs to be done and the information that needs to be provided, and especially if you have something like this where it's an automatic expungement and that was some victims of crimes, the prosecutors want to be able to make sure that they've talked to the victims and know that that is likely to be expunged. So those are a couple of things that we're hoping to work with Representative Champion on.
Thank you, Ms.
Hudson. And Mr. Chair, that's our commitment to work with Nancy Haas and the others, and we have the commitment that if this particular bill goes forward, that prior to the next stop, that we would have those things rectified and present them to the next committee, which I believe would be public safety.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need you to know that that would be by Tuesday.
By Tuesday?
That would be by Tuesday, because that would be our next hearing, and that would be when the report would be coming to the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Champion.
And Representative Hilstrom, we will do everything within our power. There's a cliche that says where there's a will, there's a way, and there is a will, and so we will make a way.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Haas.
Just one more quick comment on the A1 amendment. I just want to mention that we haven't had a chance to review this, and so I am going to reserve judgment on the impact of this and be happy to share that with Representative Champion and you once we have a chance to look at this more closely.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Haas. Representative Champion, it is the intention of the chair to lay this bill over, as I stated, and there is a strong likelihood that we're going to have a committee next week in order to go over a couple of other items in order to get this before Chair Hilstrom's committee by the required deadline, and Chair Hilstrom stated that would be by Tuesday. They're going to be here because their omnibus bill is going to be coming out the following day. So that is the intention right now. Are there any other testifiers in the audience who wish to testify on this bill, House File 891, as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief because I know time is tight. Todd Wilson Cliff, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I'd also like to thank Representative Champion and the Council on Crime and Justice. We're trying to work with them on a couple of concerns we have. We have concerns with Section 6 of the bill and the change in the requirements for an expungement. The normal expungement process is a petition has to be filed 60 days before a hearing. This would require that or allow a petitioner to make an oral or written motion at that time. We have concerns about the timing of that and whether or not the judicial officer would have the all the information in front of him or her at that time, as well as no petition is required and just that all the relevant information is there. So, again, we are working with Representative Champion and the proponent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lusenquist. Seeing no other testifier, House Chair lays over House File 891.
And Representative Champion, I will be in touch with you about this in a subsequent hearing, okay?
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Champion, are you prepared to proceed on House File 1518?
I am.
Okay. Chair would move House File 1518. Representative Champion, to your bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is an agency bill, and they've come to me and asked me to put forward this legislation or this bill. As you see, it's to, for lack of a better word, change the timing in which they have to provide the report to the legislature. Currently, the law says it's every year on this issue of human trafficking. All the stakeholders, including the department, would like it to be every 3 years versus every 2 years. I mean, every 1 year. And I do have here Susan Elwell of the Office of Justice Programs that will testify to why this is important and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Ms. Elwell. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Elwell with the Office of Justice Programs, Department of Public Safety, here on House File 1518, which only seeks to change the reporting requirement for the human trafficking report from every year to every 3 years. For the past 3 years, the Statistical Analysis Center at OJP has collected information, conducted surveys, and generated a report to the legislature, which has provided great information on the state of trafficking in Minnesota, provided a face to trafficking, and has really informed the discussion on trafficking, which we're going to be talking about later this morning. But the nature of trafficking and crime victimization doesn't change dramatically from year to year, and that conducting this report every year is a lot of time as well as money, and that this could easily be done every 3 years, providing a compelling report and probably more comprehensive report on a three-year schedule.
Thank you. Are there questions by committee members for Ms. Elwell? Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Elwell, with up until this point you've had annual reports. Have the statistics changed markedly from year to year in these annual reports?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shemansky. No, they have not. There's been solidifying the information that we have, but we haven't seen dramatic increases in the numbers that are being reported.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1518? Okay. Seeing none, then the Chair renews his motion that House File 1518 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Champion.
Thank you.
Is Representative Clark here still? Oh, she is. Okay. Representative Clark, because you're short on time, I'm going to have you testify to 1636, your bill. It is included in the omnibus bill. I will not proceed on that one yet, but if you could just describe the portions of your bill. And the chair will move House File 1636 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Chair Hillstrom's Committee of Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As you mentioned, this is part of a larger bill on sex trafficking, and you know, a lot of people have been working on these issues for a while, a lot of years. Some of you probably know that, and it's been an issue that I've been concerned about. This particular part of the bill deals with the services that people who are being trafficked do need, and it's, you know, some of the things are very basic, like housing and opportunities to have a some counseling and a roof over their head and so on. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today, hopefully establish some more information about the need for those kinds of infrastructure services and how they would be administered. And I believe there is also a fiscal note that is available to that deals with this. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on a couple of people to actually kind of flesh this out for you. If you look at the bill, you see that it does involve a plan for a service that would be developed. It spells out a bit about the programs. One of the features that I'd like to point out is that we are going to pay special attention to this bill for a program for American Indian women and also keeping track of some of the data. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to ask a few witnesses to kind of spell this out for you a little bit more.
Please do so. Please introduce yourself to the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellison, and I'm a staff attorney with the Advocates for Human Rights, a nonprofit organization. First, I would like to say that this services trafficking victim assistance bill is very important to human trafficking victims, and we will call on a few other people to testify in just a few minutes. First, just a few facts. Only one service provider in Minnesota has received federal anti-trafficking grant money to provide direct services to trafficked persons. Other service providers seeing trafficked persons must find other means to provide the necessary service to their clients. Service providers reported that the lack of data on sex trafficking makes it difficult to secure funding. We have no numbers, only anecdotes, one service provider said. Less than 100 beds are available statewide to provide emergency shelter to youth, and frequently shelters have waiting lists for those spaces. Most organizations lack transitional and permanent housing facilities, which service providers emphasize are crucial to transition successfully from the life of prostitution and sex trafficking. And I quote an advocate and survivor, "It can take 2 years to get a grip. So how can you rebuild your life if you don't know where you are going to lay your head?" Another service provider said, "We need services that are ready when we are ready. But there's a 6 month to 2 year waiting list. There's a feeling of hopelessness with that. They think I don't see a better option for myself." With that, I'd like to ask three service providers to talk about the needs of those clients that they serve. And first, I'd like to call Vanita Carter from Breaking Free.
Ms. Carter, please introduce yourself to the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and other committee members. My name is Vanita Carter, and I'm the founder and executive director of Breaking Free. We're an agency that provides services to help women and girls get out of prostitution. We've been in existence since 1996. And basically what I would like to say is that we provide a number of different services. The foundation of our services is the housing programs that we provide. We have a 17-unit apartment building, which provides permanent housing for women, and then we have a transitional house that is a 7-bedroom home where women can stay for up to 2 years and they receive intensive case management services. Now, we understand and realize the difficulty it is for an individual who's been involved in prostitution to get out of that life. It does take a while for her to be able to say that she has even been involved, because it's not something that you are readily talking about to everybody. One thing about Breaking Free is that is all that we do is provide services specifically to this population. So women do feel a little bit more comfortable when they come there, because they know that that is all that we do and that we don't judge them. We understand the shame and the blame that they have on themselves. But we have to provide a variety of services, because so many of them have experienced so many different things in their life. We work with child protection, probation. We work with a lot of outside agencies in order to get the services that the individual needs when she comes in, depending on where she's at. I just wanted to say that for young women 25 and under, many of them have traffickers, so their situation even becomes more difficult. They're lured into this life by these traffickers, and they have been told things. They've been filled with fear. They can't get out. They're kind of like a battered woman. I always say, maybe to a more extreme case, their lives have been threatened. Many of them have gotten involved as young girls. We just had a 14-year-old that came to our office just this week that was trying to escape and hide from a trafficker that she had. Now, when they have traffickers, the whole situation changes. It does become more difficult to help them get out, because on so many occasions, what we have to do is relocate them. They literally have to leave their environment because of the fear and because of the damages that can be done to them. Some of them can lose their lives. This is all very real. And it's things that you might not ever hear about, you might not ever see, but this happens on a daily basis with women that we work with, women and girls. We work with up to 400 women and girls a year. And so we understand the complicated
the complications, I'll say, of helping them to get out of the life of prostitution and the services that it takes and the money that it takes to do that. So.
Thank you, Ms. Carter. And Ms. Ellison, do you have another testifier also?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, with your permission, I'd like to also call Suzanne Keplinger from the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Keplinger. Please introduce yourself for the record. And I know you had to make your testimony short yesterday as well. I apologize for that. We are in a time schedule, so if you could be as brief as possible. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I'll do my best. Committee members, Suzanne Keplinger from the Minnesota Indian Women Resource Center. I just want to address the specific need for support services for American Indian victims of trafficking and sexual exploitation. We are seeing increased evidence that particularly young Native American women and children are being trafficked into prostitution. We're working with the Minneapolis Police Department. We have Inspector Lucy Gerald here from the 3rd Precinct today. We're trying to work with the MPD team to do outreach to these young Native girls to try and defer them out of this life and get them into culturally appropriate services. But the services are minimal, and our resources are very limited, so we really need some additional resources to provide the services. One quick story, why we need to do this. We recently worked with a woman who had been trafficked into prostitution at the age of 9. She was doing time at the workhouse on prostitution charges, and we tried to find her a bed when she was released from the workhouse. We couldn't find her a place to stay, so she went back to her pimp, and 2 weeks later, her body was found in an alley in northeast Minneapolis. That's the reality, that's what we're dealing with, and that's why we need your support.
Thank you, Ms. Keplinger. Was that all for the testifiers you had, Ms. Ellison?
Mr. Chair, we do have one other testifier, if you give us your permission.
Sure, please do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to call Artika Roller from Pride.
Ms. Roller, please introduce yourself for the record.
Committee Chair, my name is Artika Roller. I'm with Family and Children's Service Pride Program. The Pride Program has worked with helping women and teens escape prostitution for over 30 years. We also service about 400 women a year, with 140 with intensive case management. When I say intensive case management, these are women that have that are involved. We kind of do a hub and spoke kind of case management, where we're the hub, and then we're connecting the spokes. That could be child protection, probation, parenting classes, whatever her requirements are, we are trying to help her manage all of those different things in her life. We also do teen intervention and prevention. Without this funding or additional funding, we have a hard time keeping up with technology. Teens are sexually exploited through technology. Text messaging, Facebook, MySpace, those are the methods that teens are exploited, and we have a hard time keeping up with that technology with our current resources. We would say if we could get the resources, because every year we tend to cut staff or get part-time staff, we could save about 5 jobs. The main part of our agency is behavioral health. We offer the women therapy, behavioral health access, and support groups, that social emotional piece that they need to recover from the trauma they have experienced. Last, I would like to say, or leave you with a story. Last Friday, I received a call from a woman that we met doing outreach in the court. She was charged with prostitution. She decided that she wanted to leave her pimp. When she was released from jail, we could not find her a place to stay. She called and she said, "I can't go back to him. He beats me. I'm scared. I'm going to be in trouble because I was picked up in the first place. And where can I go?" We do have agreements with several shelters that say that they will take the women, but unfortunately, those shelters were filled on a Friday afternoon. We finally, after about 4 hours of calling different shelters, some shelters she was not eligible for because she had a criminal background, and so they would not let her stay there. After 4 hours, we were able to find her a place to stay around 7 o'clock last Friday evening.
Thank you, Ms. Roller. Other questions from members? Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. for Ms. Ellison or any of the testifiers, I truly appreciate the work that you people are doing to help these victims of human trafficking and so forth. But my question is, are any of them willing to identify the trafficker and get them prosecuted and get them out of the business?
Ms. Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Szymanski, thank you for the question. That is a very difficult dynamic, and they oftentimes, in working with, being willing to testify against their trafficker or their pimp is a very difficult process. The women, as Ms. Roller, Ms. Keplinger, and Ms. Carter have said, have a lot of fear of their trafficker, and so getting them to the point of being able to testify against their trafficker or their pimp is a long process. And that's why these services are so critical, is because we need to get the victims of this terrible human rights violation to the point where they feel comfortable, safe, and ready emotionally and physically in every other way to be able to go to a point of testifying against the person that has abused and exploited them. In some countries, there is actually a waiting period before law enforcement is able to work with trafficking victims. In some countries it's 30 days, in some countries it's 60 days, even up to 90 days, to give a little bit of time for the victim of trafficking to get stabilized and be at a place where they can testify. That's not something we're asking for in the statutes this year, but that gives you a sense of how long it actually does take for the women, girls, and even sometimes boys who are involved in this to get to a place where they're ready.
Absolutely, Ms. Keplinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, at the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center, we realize that for a lot of these younger women, they're not going to talk to the cops, they're not going to talk to a prosecutor, but they will talk to our staff. They'll talk to someone they feel safe with. So we did a training recently with Minneapolis Police Sergeant Bill Blake and former U.S. Attorney Tom Heffelfinger to train my staff so that if that young girl says, I don't want this guy to do this to anybody else, my staff knows what information they need to gather so that they can get the corroborative evidence to help build that case. But as Mary said, it's very difficult for these girls. They're terrified, they're traumatized, they often don't make good witnesses, and so it's difficult to prosecute the cases. But I think it's important to look at this holistically and how we can all begin to work together to help those girls come forward, to help them feel safe, and part of that is giving them housing and supportive services that they need so that they can then in turn be ready and feel strong enough that they can help with the prosecution.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from any other members? We do have five more bills to go, members also in committee. So, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank all of the testifiers. Your testimony is both riveting and just disturbing to know what's happening, especially to these young women and the girls as young as 9 years old into the system. I'm wondering kind of what your interaction is with Child Protective Services and obviously, we've got a short-term and then a longer-term problem in trying to get these young women into more stable environments. And those that are so young, they need parenting and homes. I mean, is an attempt to get them into foster homes if their home environment is perhaps part of the reason they're in this predicament?
Ms. Keplinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we had a conversation with Hennepin County Child Protection about this very issue, and a couple of barriers are in place. A lot of the girls are runaways, so they're not from the county where the case is coming up. They're often not reported as a trafficking or a child protection case. They're reported as a juvenile prostitution case. So they don't get to the child protection caseworkers. Another problem is that a lot of the parents either don't know what their child is doing or don't care what their child is doing. So we're running into a lot of barriers in actually working more collaboratively and holistically with the child welfare system. Not to say that that's not a good goal, but I think there's a number of dynamics in place with the factors of these children being runaways from other counties, being throwaways, aging out of the foster care system, and the foster parents really don't care what they're doing anymore. We do need to continue to work with them. When reunification is possible, we are able to do that, and I think there are other agencies that are doing the same work.
Representative Szymanski? I'm sorry, Representative Lou, did you have a follow-up? Okay, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this may go to the author of the bill. Representative Clark, but I believe it was Ms. Carter talked about a program called Breaking Free, and there was a 2-year transition, to where, the victims could stay within that facility up to 2 years. But in the bill that's before us, Representative Clark, I don't see any time limit or mention of duration on benefits, from public services.
Representative Clark.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Representative Stansky. There's not a time limit in this bill. I think what was being referred to was the use of time limit that comes with transitional housing. I just want to, and maybe she can say some more about that, Carter. I did want to say that, when this bill is done going through the other committees, if there's time, I'd like to take it to my own committee again. We deal with the issues of housing. And if there's not time for it to come through, we will at least address it in some way in the omnibus bill in my committee, because this is a very important need to housing. And there's ways that we can get our existing housing finance agency to maybe we need to set aside, and maybe we need a particular focus on this that's not been.
Questions from other members regarding the bill, House File 1636. Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 1636? And let's see, anyone, and there are two other articles, two other bills additionally on this, as well as the omnibus bill members, so there will be other opportunities for some questions here in the next few minutes. Therefore, Chair renews his motion that House File 1636 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tamar, are you prepared to proceed on 1505? Representative Tamar, Chair will move House File 1505 that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. To your bill.
Chair, thanks for moving my bill in your committee.
Oh, you're welcome, Mr. Chair. Just returning the favor.
Where is this going again, Mr. Chair, to Public Safety?
This is going to Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, you've already heard significant testimony on the impact of trafficking in the state of Minnesota and what we're trying to accomplish here today. So I'm not going to go into any detail, but just explain the basic things that we're amending here in statute. We're amending the criminal code, the section under sexual and labor trafficking crimes. We're amending some new language under labor trafficking. We're amending some new language under sex trafficking. And we're also amending language under solicitation, inducement, and promotion, and adding the word sex trafficking under 609.322. We're also adding enhanced penalties for aggravating factors. And we're adding sex trafficking to the crime of violence that's in current statute. And we're also amending the 611A section on employer retaliation that would allow a victim of trafficking or a witness to be able to take time off of work to attend a court hearing. So that's basically what it does. I'd like Ms. Ellison to elaborate further, and we do have a witness from the St. Paul Police Department also, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tamar. Before we do, we should move the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment is not quite ready for prime time, so we're going to withhold that and fix it and offer it in Representative Hilton's committee.
Great. Thank you, Representative Tamar. Then Ms. Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to call Officer Heather Weicker of the St. Paul Police Department. She is with the Vice Unit and is also serving on the Human Trafficking Task Force.
Thank you, Officer Weicker.
Good morning, Mr. Lesh, committee chair and committee members. My name is Heather Weicker. I'm a police officer investigator with the St. Paul Police Department. I would like to express my department's strong support for the bill to combat human trafficking in Minnesota being introduced today. I've been in law enforcement for the past 16 years and have seen the devastating effects that the crime has had on the victims and the community. sex trafficking and sexual exploitation, including the promotion of prostitution, results in serious physical and psychological injuries to the victims. The criminals, the procurers, and the opportunists, both men and women alike, instill fear in their victims. They demoralize, destroy self-esteem and self-worth. For these reasons, it is our experience that it is very difficult to get cooperation from our victims in order to get successful prosecutions against the opportunists. So imposing stricter penalties could and would secure further safety and rehabilitation time to heal for our victims. In a recent case, earlier this week, we did a detail. We came across a young woman, age of 18, who had been trafficked into prostitution since she was 14 years old. We could not find a successful place to place her. We could not find her a bed away from her trafficker. She was so extremely fearful of this gentleman, and I can't call him a gentleman, individual trafficker, that she did not want to be with him. Because we could not secure a facility, once she was released from jail, she was placed back into, she was released and went directly back to her pimp, and we saw her yesterday, again on Craigslist, less than 36 hours later, posing herself and selling herself. And it is because of this fear for against her trafficker that she went back to him. Sexual violence cost the state of Minnesota $8 billion in 2005, and it is likely that this number does not capture prostitution or other forms of commercial sexual exploitation. That is a report by the Minnesota Department of Health in July of 2007. This crime also harms our communities by putting our children at risk, facilitating illegal drug use, and endangering all those who come in contact with transactions in the sex trade. Those who engage in selling other people for sex are dangerous criminals, and they need to be held accountable for their crimes. The changes proposed to Minnesota law in this bill will do just that. They will enable law enforcement and prosecutors to more easily hold offenders accountable. They will also allow longer sentences for those traffickers who are repeat offenders, those who have trafficked more than one victim, and those who have enslaved the victims for over 180 days. There are also numerous provisions that would provide services for trafficking victims and training for those of us who are on the front lines of dealing with this crime and trying to educate others to basically spread the word. All of this is urgently needed in the state of Minnesota and is more effectively address the crime of human sex trafficking. We must work together from the moment of discovery of those responsible for sex trafficking to the recovery of those victims by sex trafficking. We are proud and privileged to be part of this effort and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weicker. Are there questions from committee members for Ms. Weicker and Ms. Ellison on this? Seeing none, and since we are moving at the Chair Hillstrom's committee, we can deal with the amendment before then. Are there any other individuals in the audience who would like to testify to House File 1505? Not seeing any. The Chair will withdraw his motion and have Representative Tamar move that his own bill go to Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. The Chair will note that House File 1810 has been, I'm not bringing that forward, that'll be removed from the agenda. I'm going to go to one. Yeah, we'll do that one. We will proceed with House File 1461, that's mine, and Representative Szymanski will chair during that period. Also, for the benefit of members of the audience, House File 1768 is an omnibus bill which includes articles that are Representative Tamar's Bill 1505, Representative Clark's Bill 1636, and my Bill 1461, on which I will proceed right now. After I proceed with that, we will go to House File 1449, the Criminal Intelligence Data Bill.
Chairman Lesh, welcome to the Committee on Crime Victims and Criminal Records.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1461, which, for the benefit of folks, is Article 2 of the Omnibus Bill, House File 1768, and which would be included in that bill along with Representative Clark's and Representative Tamar's bill. And if I could, we have the experts here, Mr. Chair, and members, so I will just ask Ms. Ellison to testify to the provisions in there.
Welcome again to the committee, Ms. Ellison. Please introduce yourself once more for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Mary Ellison. I am a staff attorney with the Advocates for Human Rights. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House File 1461 has to do with training and public awareness about human trafficking. It provides for training for law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, service providers about how to identify trafficking victims, to develop protocols to recognize the victims and to respond appropriately. It's very important that we expand public awareness. The story of human trafficking has been one that we have all seen in the news, but that story has been one that has been in part told from a federal perspective. We need to tell our Minnesota story about what sex trafficking is in Minnesota. We've heard a lot of compelling testimony today from the service providers who work with individuals who are trafficked into prostitution. And we need to broaden public awareness that sex trafficking is not only about foreign nationals, it's about our own Minnesota sisters, brothers, aunts, and friends. It is also not limited to cases involving force, fraud, and coercion, which is something that is in the federal law, and it's not limited to cases involving movement across the border. The training that we would be providing for in with this bill would be, again, it would help to educate our law enforcement, our prosecutors, and all of the professionals who deal with these types of cases and provide training materials. The fiscal note on this provision of the bill is that there would be a half-time training and public awareness coordinator that would be needed in the Department of Public Safety, that there would be 4 regional trainings for law enforcement at the cost of $20,000, 4 regional trainings for service providers at a cost of $20,000, a report back to the legislature at a cost of $7,000, and some public awareness materials in multiple languages at a cost of $7,000. And the cost for that training and public awareness coordinator would be $35,000. We think this is a very small price to pay to address the figure that one of our testifiers mentioned earlier, that there's an $8 billion cost to sexual violence in Minnesota. Here we would be spending $89,000 to deal with that cost. It's a small investment that we can make here in Minnesota to train and educate everyone in the public as well as the professionals to really address this issue.
Thank you, Ms. Ellison. Chairman Lesh, do you have any other testifiers for the bill?
We don't have any other testifiers and no other comments, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions from committee members or anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill?
Then I would renew my motion that it be recommended pass and move down to Chair Hilstrom's committee, Mr. Chair.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Pass.
Mr. Chair, I would also at this time, without any additional testimony on it, but just move the omnibus bill, which includes the previous 3 bills on which we just heard testimony, that being House File 1768.
Okay. Representative Lesh moves House File 1768.
And then it be recommended to pass and re-referred to Chair Hilstrom's Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Is there any question or comment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Yeah. Motion passed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Lesh.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
I would move my House file 1449, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any recommendations, Mr. Lesh, Representative Lesh?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, by way of explanation, House File 1449 was brought to me, and I will talk briefly while I set up their presentation. I have some folks here with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I have spoken with many of my friends in the peace community and civil libertarians who had expressed some concerns about the bill. When it was brought to me, I looked at several provisions on which I had questions and did ask the BCA about that. I also asked some of the other people who will be testifying in opposition about that. And it seems to me this is one of those areas that, based on technology and criminal data in the direction things are moving, that a version of this will happen in future years, if not this year. And members, I think it's pivotal, as we've seen with the history of the Patriot Act, that we have a discussion on these kinds of provisions at a time like this, rather than in the wake of some other earth-shattering event that has people running for the hills and wondering what kind of legislation we can enact that could potentially go too far. And I think that's why it's really important that the discussion be had now, when cooler heads can prevail about what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate. I would also state that when I authored the bill and asked for a hearing, I knew that after this hearing I would probably discover many things that I didn't know ahead of time. And so I think it's very important that this discussion be had, and that also people be reasonable in terms of what they think are appropriate measures. The last item I would add, Mr. Chair and members, is that I was kind of surprised to discover who was supporting this and who wasn't supporting this. I note that the point of this bill is to encourage the sharing of information among agencies. And, of course, as we know, individual agencies have now played their cards close to the vest individually on their own, and have been able to mask or hide data, criminal intelligence data, on their own without the benefit necessarily of any law. This, in the encouraging of sharing of information among agencies, would put that information in the pipeline and subject to litigation in a way that it caps out, at least in this version, 1 year. That they have to get their act together in a year, and potentially based on an amendment, it might have to happen sooner. But we think that actually encourages the sunshine, at least on certain provisions of information that, at least as far as right now, has not been out there. So with that, I would ask, Mr. Chair, that I have a couple of testifiers from the BCA who can speak more specifically to the individual provisions.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. my name is Dave Bierga, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We're here to present an issue that was identified last summer by the Privacy Policy Committee for the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, the Minnesota Fusion Center. While the Department of Public Safety is the agency bringing this issue forward, it may occur in any Minnesota law enforcement agency. Specifically, law enforcement may have what this bill calls criminal intelligence data, but does not classify it in any consistent way. Harm to the reputations of many people can result. To help explain this issue, we have three scenarios which will allow us to testify further from these scenarios. So just bear with me. Scenario number one. Bob and Sally are new to the neighborhood. They notice that the house across the street has different cars coming at all hours of the day and night. No car is parked for more than 15 minutes. As members of Neighborhood Watch, Bob and Sally call their local police department to report the activity. Officer Jones runs a check on the address and finds no report. He includes the information from Bob and Sally on his daily briefing sheet. Scenario two, a citizen of France enrolls in flight school in the city of Anywhere. On a third day of class, he tells the instructor that he is not interested in learning how to land a plane as he won't need to know how. The instructor files a report with the Anywhere Police Department. And scenario three, Fargo has experienced a rash of burglaries during funeral services. No similar events have been reported in Moorhead. The Fargo Police Department decides to send information to the Moorhead Police Department so that Moorhead can anticipate similar activity there. To provide the committee with a more detailed explanation of the problem and, importantly, the proposed solution, I would like to introduce Katie Engler, who is currently on assignment to the Minnesota Justice Information Services at the BCA.
Welcome, Ms. Engler. Please approach the microphone, introduce yourself for the tape, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Katie Engler. As the Assistant Superintendent just said, I am currently on assignment at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Right now, law enforcement uses community policing as a concept to assist them in addressing concerns of public safety in the community. Information, as has been noted, is currently in law enforcement's hands, but there is inconsistent treatment of how that data are handled across law enforcement agencies. In the scenarios that you just saw, no crime has been committed in Minnesota. However, the information that was presented may be a predictor of future criminal activity. However, disclosure of that information could be detrimental. First of all, to public safety. Premature disclosure could result in the wrongdoer finding out that law enforcement is aware of what the wrongdoer is planning and can avoid, take steps to avoid detection. Secondly, for those against whom allegations have been made that later prove to be unfounded, there is a potential harm to reputation and an invasion of individual privacy. In addition, premature disclosure, it provides some disincentive. First of all, if citizens know that they're going to be associated with information they provide to law enforcement, they may stop providing that, thus destroying the concept of community policing. Secondly, there's a possibility that law enforcement will not document information they receive so that there are no records to find. And finally, non-Minnesota law enforcement agencies may choose not to share information with Minnesota because we have no method of consistently protecting the information that they send. So before you today is a proposed solution to the problem. In it, we define a new type of data. And I need to make clear that it's not authority to gather data, but rather that it would classify data that are gathered. We called it criminal intelligence data. It is a new section proposed in Chapter 13, the Data Practices Act, and it would apply to all law enforcement. Data that meets the definition of criminal intelligence data would be classified as confidential data on individuals or protected non-public data, which, for those who are not familiar with the definitions, means that the data not only are not accessible to the public, but are also not accessible to the individuals who are the subjects of the data. And because of that classification, there's also a need for you and the legislature to authorize the use of that criminal intelligence data. The bill, as proposed, also includes protection. First of all, a criminal predicate is required before law enforcement can keep criminal intelligence data. And criminal predicate has been defined in the bill, and it is facts and inferences that someone who's working either as a trained law enforcement officer or under the supervision of a trained law enforcement officer results in a reasonable belief that there's a reasonable possibility that there will be criminal or terrorist activity. Secondly, the classification proposed protects the person making the report. It also protects the person described in the report so that for those allegations that are without foundation, there is no harm to reputation. The proposal also includes the idea that the classification changes from confidential to private, which then becomes acceptable as subject to data, if certain criteria laid out in the bill are not met. This classification would allow the individual to review the data about themselves and bring any challenges to accuracy and completeness. And finally, there's a provision that says that informed consent by an individual who has private data that are criminal intelligence data is not effective for transferring that information to third parties. There are also accountability provisions in the bill. As I said, there are criteria established for data usage. First of all, there has to be a criminal predicate. Secondly, what we've called association data, which are data about people based on their religious, political, or social views, cannot be kept or used by law enforcement. When the data are private, the subject gets the ability to review the data. A time period for retention is set in the bill. If law enforcement shares the information, a log is required. And finally, the existing remedies in the Data Practices Act, which is Chapter 13, apply to this data, include both civil remedies, and penalties, including discipline of employees. So why act now? As Representative Les mentioned in his introduction, we're not currently in a crisis situation. However, we do know that the advent of technology and the continuing efforts by the federal government are using information technology to increase sharing across the country to try to address these types of issues. There's more interest in this type of information gathering, and information is moving across state lines. Without the legislation, we have inconsistent treatment of this information across law enforcement in Minnesota, and we have the potential that law enforcement agencies outside of the state will not send information here because we are unable to promise protection for it. So I'm going to quickly walk through the specific subdivisions in the bill. The first subdivision is the definitional section. The second subdivision provides for the classification of the data and sets the retention period. The third subdivision is the authorization for sharing. The fourth are the data prohibitions. And finally, the fifth subdivision is the dissemination record requirement. And with that, we are prepared to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee members? Or is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify for or against this bill?
We did, and Mr. Chair, I did know that there were a couple members who I did put on the list, and for those of you who mentioned to me you wanted to be placed on the list, you are on there, but please just come forward anyway and introduce yourself. And I know there are probably many people who are not on the list, but we want to make sure we hear from everyone who wishes to be heard on this.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Good morning, sir. Would you please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 789. I'd like to thank the committee. I'd like to thank Representative Lesh. We've had earlier discussions about this bill. Quite honestly, we have some real concerns that we hope can be worked out about this bill. We're concerned that labor organizations might somehow be mislabeled and thrown into this bill or fall under it. For instance, when a labor union in the course of a labor dispute engages in nonviolent civil disobedience to move that dispute along, we're afraid that they might be labeled as a criminal organization. And we're very conscious of and appreciate the work the law enforcement agencies do, but we also don't want to be hindered or perhaps restricted in some of the things that we have to do to bring about economic justice for workers and that. We're certainly not criminals, so those are my remarks, and I'll take any questions.
Yeah. Are there any questions on the committee for the testifier? Hearing none, we'll proceed to our next testifier. Please introduce yourself for the case and proceed.
Hello, I'm Grace Kelly. I am a peace advocate. I'm a political activist, and I'm a citizen journalist. I am totally committed to peace and law, yet I feel directly and completely targeted by this bill. In the peace community, we have a long history of our groups being infiltrated, by people who are watching us because they, quote, anticipate that we might do something wrong. And there is substantial and long historical documentation that would take a long time to present, so I gave you a handout. And it starts with, I have a very sincere favor to ask. But all of us in the peace community, no matter who, have stories about this. When you say criminal activity, incite to riot is a criminal activity. Yet most of us who protest do not consider that an incite to riot. We consider it our right to free speech and our right to assemble. And that's all it takes for us to be anticipated to be criminals. And if you look at the later in the bill, not only do you use words like anticipate and prevent, like on line 1.11, later on you see a 1.18. There is a reasonable possibility. I think that just about lets anything in the world to do. If you look on the next page, you have the words, influence the policy of the state. Every single thing I do is an attempt to influence the policy of the state. And intimidate. Well, I don't think I'm intimidating, but I have threatened representatives to walk their whole precinct and knock on every door and talk to every voter. And some people consider that intimidation. I use my voice. I use my writing. I walk the streets using a video camera. I record what I see. Yet, I think this bill directly targets me. Putting the only thing that stops police from doing things is public oversight. The fact that everything that they do is going to be looked at with public scrutiny. Even with public scrutiny, we had people pepper sprayed who did nothing wrong from like that far away. Public scrutiny is the check and balance. In principle, this bill removes that check and balance. Once you set the standard that data is kept secret, then everything the police do can be kept secret. The fact that you have a one year does not prevent anything. Because now you've established the standard. All you have to do now is have a moving date. And if you look further down in the bill, it says for more than 3 years. If you look down further, it says on 2.26, last date the classification changed. So, gee, all I have to do every 3 years to keep my information on Grace Kelly is toggle the classification, which takes me all of 2 seconds, and then all of a sudden I get another 3 years. In the news media, even a day is a long time. Right now, we are still trying to get data about what happened in the RNC, the Republican National Convention that happened here in St. Paul. And we are still having problems. And if you do this, then suddenly we are talking about 1 to 3 years, and then the clock starts where maybe we can have pressure. And then all that has to happen is a reclassification, and then that data is legally able to be kept from us. Right now we're having difficulties. Do not change the standard of public oversight. I stand in opposition to this bill.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Is there anyone else that needs to testify? We're limited to just a few minutes here, so if you keep your testimony short, we will move to a conclusion of our committee hearing soon. Thank you. Introduce yourself for the tape, please, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal counsel for the ACLU of Minnesota. We're a statewide affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union, and we have more than 11,000 members here in Minnesota. We oppose House File 1449 because we believe that this will provide a roadmap to law enforcement agencies to create and maintain
secret political dossiers on people engaged in First Amendment activity, political activists, activist groups. We believe that we should not sacrifice liberty for the illusion of security that bills like this, this bill provide. The provisions in the bill that include, that have limits on association data collection, that require a criminal predicate before you collect data, provide very little comfort, and I'll explain why. Just by way of an example, we're in St. Paul, and the St. Paul Legislative Code, Chapter 366A, prohibits public demonstrations of more than 25 people without a permit. Now, a violation of that provision is a misdemeanor. That's a criminal offense. My reading of the statute is that if there's a reasonable possibility that somebody is planning a demonstration without a permit, people attending that demonstration, there's a reasonable possibility that 26 people show up, all of those people would satisfy the criminal predicate, allowing law enforcement to gather information about them. The problem is compounded when you have the secrecy provisions keeping this information secret. There's very little oversight for the public to actually look at and learn that their information has been kept for these reasons. Now, minor offenses, civil disobedience, things like that are really not the type of information that should be classified as criminal intelligence data. Even the federal government recognizes that. Regulations that have been in place since long before the Bush administration and all through the Bush administration state that the areas of criminal activity for which intelligence information is to be utilized, they have to represent a significant and recognized threat to the population. They have to be either undertaken for the purpose of seeking illegal power or to pose a threat to the life and property of others. They have to involve a significant degree of permanent criminal organization, and they're not limited to, or they're not limited to one jurisdiction. These are controls that are included in the federal regulations that this bill simply does not have. Another area, the definition of criminal predicate in this bill is a watered-down version of reasonable suspicion embodied in the Fourth Amendment. And even unlike the federal regulations, which require law enforcement training, trained law enforcement officers to determine it, this defers it to any employee of a law enforcement agency. There's no training required. Does that mean a file clerk could decide there's sufficient reasonable suspicion or a paid informant can decide this? This bill is insufficient to protect people.
Ms. Nelson?
Yes. Okay, so in the interest of time, you know, there are multiple examples of police agencies around the country spying on peaceful groups. I urge this committee to oppose this bill. And thank you for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Just by way of, and I'm sure there are other testifiers in opposition, Mr. Chair, but I would like to get through, go past what would normally be committee time in order to get the testifiers in, because there may be several.
Okay, Mr. Lesh, Representative Lesh, I would like to extend the committee by about 5 more minutes, if that would be appropriate, or do you think we'll need more time than that? At 10:30, there will be another committee meeting here.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, if we can go to 10:30, then I would appreciate that time for us to be able to do that.
All right. We have another testifier, Representative Lesh.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would also, if I may, Mr. Chair, I know that the BCA would like to issue a brief a statement in response in closing, if we could, just at the end.
Yes. We will do that, Mr. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rick Neumeister. I'd like to make some comments briefly in a general overall, and I'll get to some specific subjects of the bill. Number one, this is not no easy kind of thing to do. This is a hard thing. So let's say BCA gets their point of view, testifiers say something, BCA gets their point of view. You've got to hear both sides. Former legislator a long time ago said bad legislation, Jack Davies said, bad legislation is made with either bad information or no information at all. So on something like this, I think it's important that there has to be very much due diligence because it affects your rights, your constituent rights, and my rights. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll just go on to the following. Historically, when there was a fair amount of discussion almost 33 years ago about should the state of Minnesota do intelligence gathering, This is when the sort of like at the birth of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. Well, there was a fair amount of discussion about intelligence. Chief McCutcheon, Assistant Chief McCutcheon talked about some of that. And if you go back to some of the records, what they decided at that time, just put investigative data, not intelligence data. And they also sort of said that all, there should be no secret sauce. And there are ways in our act to make sure that at least subjects of people are aware of what's happening about the files that are kept by government about them. But we have changed over those 30 years to where, is there a need for intelligence? I will admit, yes, there is a need for intelligence, but it needs some big statutory restraint, accountability, transparency, and very real definition that this bill does not have at all. Now, if you do a comparison into some other states that have done a number of things, whether it be like the Law Enforcement Intelligence Network of Iowa, you can talk about the Oregon Intelligence, you can talk about New Jersey Intelligence Gathering, they have a lot of different kinds of things than we do. And I'll give you an example. Like, for example, if you look at the language, where it says the definition of criminal intelligence data means the data law enforcement agency uses to anticipate, prevent, or monitor possible criminal or terrorist activity. At least some of the statutes or ordinances that I've reviewed from Colorado, Oregon, and Iowa, and I think New Jersey, have a term actual or attempted planning, organizing, financing, or committing. It narrows down that general the general definition. In an overall sense of, I think, about six areas that I have concerns about is the definition, how data is collected, relationship to the First Amendment, the sharing policy, and the accountability transparency. There, if you take a look at the issue of dissemination records and purging, from my perspective, there's nothing in detail. If you take a look at what some of the other states have adopted and entities have adopted, it's very detailed. And it's very much open for discussion. I see where time might be starting to, I can see our chairman. But Mr. Chairman, I've done an analysis of the bill. I went with Mr. Lesh a little bit over about it. I think one big question you need to ask, if you look under 1305, subdivision 7, I believe, of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, it's basically a law or subdivision 3, it says this: collection and storage of all data on individuals and the use and dissemination of private and confidential data on individuals shall be limited to that necessary for the administration and management of programs specifically authorized by the legislature or local governing body or mandated by the federal government. My question is, we are now classifying data in an intelligence kind of way, and then I'm rhetorically asking, well, where's the authorization for that? 1997, the BCA came to the legislature, or maybe it was Senator Randy Kelly at that time, I don't know if it was a BCA initiative, that wanted to collect intelligence on gangs. So what happened is that it went through the legislative process, and it's now authorized. Now, there is debate right now that they're already doing it, and maybe a lot of folks are now doing it, but I don't know what they're collecting. You don't know what they're collecting, and I contend the way that this bill is worded is more to give, in my perspective, sort of like a cover-all to what they're now collecting. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think there's a number of questions that need to be fleshed out, and I'm more than willing to work with the chairperson, whether it be if you're going to go forward with it in the next week before deadline or over the summer, I'm willing to commit my time and effort to try and make sure that there's a balanced approach. Thank you very much for a few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Anyone else who wishes to testify for or against this bill, please come forward. Take a chair and introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Hi,
I'm Colleen Rowley, and I'm a retired FBI agent of 24 years, legal counsel for 13 years in this Minneapolis division, which I actually handled. I was the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act officer for 13 years. I was also 1 year as an informant compliance official in the FBI. And before that, I worked for about 7 years in New York on criminal intelligence collection involving the mafia. So I have a lot of perspective. Since retiring, I've actually become a peace and social justice activist. I have a lot of perspectives, and unfortunately, with a short amount of time, I am not going to be able to say just a tiny bit here. So I do hope that we get further opportunity to speak and debate these issues. But I've chosen to put my old law enforcement hat on today instead of the other things because essentially since 9/11, and I should mention too that I was a person who disclosed the FBI's lapses leading up to 9/11. That scenario 2 or 3 here was the case that I testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee. It led to a 400-page investigative report about the lapses. One of the false notions since 9/11 that leads to this massive intelligence collection has been the idea that we did not have enough dots. You know, they said it was a failure to connect the dots. And it took 2.5-3 years to learn that that really was the problem. The failure to connect the dots was the problem, not that there was not enough dots. But in the meantime, we've had this notion that by inputting massive intelligence and data on people and individuals, credit records, every agency's been caught in scandals. My own FBI was caught in 200,000 letters that that led to banking information and telephone tolls, travel information being put into computers. I'm going to just hopefully get the chance to read something that was given in testimony 1 day ago to the Homeland Security Committee in Washington, D.C., and this was a statement by Caroline Fredrickson of the ACLU. And it's the whole notion of what is intelligence. Intelligence it needs to have quotes around it because it's not intelligent, essentially. I'm going to quote Caroline here. The immediate obstacle to determining the relevance of intelligence in Homeland Security is the lack of a commonly understood definition of intelligence. People often hear the word and assume that this type of information has some magical quality, giving it heightened importance and meaning. But by its very nature, intelligence is often uncorroborated, inadequately vetted, and fragmentary at best, and unreliable, misleading, or just plain wrong at worst. This deficiency is due to the secretive manner in which intelligence agencies gather, analyze, use, and report information. By allowing people to report information against their neighbors or colleagues in secret, the social mores and legal consequences that normally restrain people from making false or misleading accusations are removed. By masking the sources and methods used to obtain this information, intelligence, in quotes, is stripped of the most essential clues for determining its value. Knowing whether an accusation that a politician is misusing campaign funds is coming from a trusted insider, a political opponent, or an unemployed cab driver makes all the difference in determining its credibility. By then compartmentalizing this information and limiting its distribution, outside experts are prevented from effectively evaluating or challenging the finished intelligence. I'll stop here. I've got this in a statement, so hopefully you'll get a chance. And it's actually, I've excerpted parts of a much longer statement. What we have, and I just have so much more here, but what we have is a false choice. Barack Obama said this in his inauguration, that for 8 years now we've been under this idea that there's a false choice between civil liberties and security. That's not true. It's just a complete myth. There's enormous convergence if we do it right. I would offer my services to the BCA, for instance, because I agree with the need to protect informant sources, the need to protect individuals and their privacy and their reputations. There's a way to do that in a much more narrow way that does not have all of this additional problems of spying on protest groups and unions and everything else.
Sure.
Thank you so much, and please give us a chance to talk further.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay. For the next testifier, please approach the microphone. Representative Lesh, did you have a comment?
Thank you. We have just two more testifiers in opposition, this being the first of the two, and the last one will be really brief, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lesh.
I'll try to be brief, too, because the other people speaking here have been quite articulate and more knowledgeable than I am. I'm Ross Raleigh. I'm kind of a reluctant, in a way, peace protester, in that I was living the normal middle class existence until the Bush administration and the Iraq War, and I decided that silence was complicity, and I decided to start protesting our government's policy. Representative Leach, in his introduction to this bill, said that it was about sharing information within law enforcement. Well, the bill itself actually says the opposite. It shares information with, and I'm trying to, I know I'm under timer straight here, I'm trying to look at the, I should have looked at the section, but essentially it shares information with corporations, business people that are associated with the infrastructure, critical infrastructure. Now, I give the example of if I somehow inaccurately get on there and it becomes secret, they can pass this information, according to this bill, on to outside people. And there's no way I can fight that. There's no way I would know it. There's no way I could fight it. I contrast that with if I get a bad credit report. If I get a bad credit report and they start putting that credit report around the businesses and stuff, I can say, oh my gosh, that's wrong, and I can legally fight that. Under this bill, if something like that would happen, there would be no way for the individual to fight this. So, anyway, I hope you at least take longer to look at this bill and look at the definitions and see how vague it is and understand why we're concerned on many different levels about the problems that would be engendered by passing this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Free testimony. And would the next testifier please come forward, state your name for the tape, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Lord. I'm a longtime political activist on foreign policy and environmental issues and some local issues. I only recently had a chance to read this bill, but I notice that legally, and some of this may be inevitable, but the way the bill is written, all of the legal leeway in deciding what is valid intelligence and in deciding what to keep, all the legal indulgence that there might be in the bill is on the side of law enforcement. And if you are the subject of such intelligence or activities on the part of the police, the burden on the subject is tremendous for dealing with, as the previous speaker alluded to, for even finding out that you were being surveilled for legal political activities and for trying to deal with what's happening to the intelligence as it's used. I think the issue of legal burden of proof or just legal burden to go through the court system to pursue, to find out whether the intelligence is private or confidential or if its status has changed is very troubling. And I think on the basis of all the objections that have been brought forth, I urge you to lay this bill over and not pass it out of committee this session. I think it's tremendously problematical, and fixing all of the legal imbalances in the bill as it's written will cause it to be pursued through the legislative process for years to come. I think if you pass this, you'll create more problems than you'll solve.
Thank you for your testimony. Yeah. Representative Lesh.
Thanks. Your Honor, we would close, but it appears Mr. Byers-Kopinski would like to
next few words.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Lori Backer-Penskamp with the Department of Administration.
Thank you for coming
my
forward.
My office.
We are very limited time.
My office provides information both to government as well as citizens and media about how the Data Practices Act works. And this is an important issue that needs to be addressed. There has always been data that law enforcement receives that doesn't raise to the level of an active criminal investigation. So as this bill moves forward, we would want to be able to glean from you how this will interact with existing provisions like 1382 and some of the things that are always public, even when an investigation is active, and just how those provisions will work together so that afterwards we can help others interpret it the way you mean it for it to be interpreted.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Sure, if I could just add my testifier from the BCA quote. Thank you.
Please proceed. Introduce yourself once more for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, again, Katie Angler with the BCA. Be brief. If you've heard, we've acknowledged the reality that these data currently exist in law enforcement. Our goal is to provide both for public safety and for some accountability and some protections for individuals who are the subject of these records. And one of the reasons we put this in Chapter 13 was to take advantage of the protections that are already in place in that law. And so with that, we look forward to working with Representative Lesh as this bill moves.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In closing, I would note, and I appreciate the testimony of both for and against on this bill. I'd specifically like to note, though, some of the concerns shared by my friends in the peace community about what's already happened to them because of the masking of what could potentially be criminal intelligence data or investigative data. And as mentioned, 1382, Government Data Practices, Subdivision 7, states specifically, except for data defined in some other subdivisions here, investigative data collected or created by a law enforcement agency in order to prepare a case against a person, whether known or unknown, for the commission of a crime or other offense for which the agency has primary investigative responsibility, is confidential or protected non-public while the investigation is active. Members, this is already happening. This is going on, and agencies are masking this data under the guise of Subdivision 7 of 1382. This bill would no longer allow law enforcement agencies to hide behind that pillar and would put a one-year cap on how long they would have to proceed under this as criminal intelligence data. That said, I think that's why the discussion is very important that we have it now when cooler heads are prevailing. And Mr. Chair, I would ask that we do lay this bill over and that we can work through some of these additional details here in the future.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. The bill is laid over.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, the committee is adjourned.